From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from St. Paul, Minnesota. In Burma, the military junta is continuing its violent crackdown on anti-government protesters. Soldiers raided monasteries and fired at demonstrators. At least 9 people were killed Thursday, including a Japanese photojournalist. We'll get the latest. Then Minneapolis is the home of the Center for Victims of Torture. We'll speak with Executive Director Douglas Johnson and with Professor Stephen Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror.
Torture. CIA psychologists took it to Guantanamo and then to Abu Ghraib. What's the latest on this story, which is ripping apart the medical profession and which is destroying the reputation of the United States around the world?
And a Minnesota immigrant rights group has sued Immigration and Customs Enforcement over its raid last year on the Swift meatpacking plant in Worthington, Minnesota. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from St. Paul, Minnesota. In Gena, Louisiana, 17-year-old Michael Bell, one of the Gena Six, has been released on bail after 10 months in prison. Bell and 5 other African-American high school students were arrested last year for beating a white student during a schoolyard fight. The fight occurred after white students hung 3 nooses in a tree in the schoolyard. An all-white jury convicted Bell of aggravated second-degree battery. But earlier this month, the Louisiana Appeals Court ruled he should not have been tried as an adult. On Thursday, Bell walked out of a prison on a $45,000 bail bond. His release came hours after District Attorney Reed Walters announced he would not challenge the ruling ordering Bell's release.
There is a victim in this case. His name is Justin Barker. I want everyone to know that the decision I am about to announce is based upon what I believe is best for him. I have decided not to appeal the decision of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals that overturned the conviction of Michael Bell in adult court and sent the case back to juvenile court. This means the case against Michael Bell will now go forward in juvenile court.
Michael Bell's release comes 1 week to the day after tens of thousands of people gathered from across the country to support the Gena Six in Gena, Louisiana. In his news conference, Walter shared his thoughts on the historic march.
I firmly believe and am confident of the fact that had it not been for the direct intervention of the Lord Jesus Christ last Thursday, a disaster would have happened. You can quote me on that.
A violent crackdown on a popular uprising in Burma is intensifying. At least 9 people were killed Thursday when police opened fire on thousands of demonstrators in the city of Rangoon. There are fears the death toll could be several times more. The Japanese photojournalist Kenji Nagai was among the dead. Video footage shows him shot point blank as soldiers charged the crowds. The junta is also trying to stem the flow of information, cutting cell phones and completely blocking public internet use. British Ambassador Mark Canning described Thursday's developments.
There was a much more visible troop presence on the streets. There were some prison vans on the streets. There were some water cannons. And there were troops stationed in a lot of the strategic areas. The main pagodas were wired off, the Shwedagon and the Sule, where the protesters had been gathering. But the protesters still came out. They confronted the troops and the police. There have been, as I say, sporadic but quite serious violence in town.
There is a victim in...
More on Burma after headlines. A congressional investigation has issued a scathing criticism of the private military firm Blackwater USA around the March 2004 mission that saw 4 of its guards killed and led to a major escalation of the war in Iraq. The House Oversight Committee says Blackwater sent the guards into the insurgent stronghold of Fallujah unprepared and lacking proper security. The guards were killed, 2 of their bodies strung over a bridge. The U.S. military responded responded with devastating attacks on Fallujah that virtually destroyed much of the city, killed thousands, and displaced many more. The House Oversight Committee also says Blackwater officials then impeded congressional efforts to investigate. The families of the four slain guards have launched a civil suit against Blackwater for alleged negligence in their deaths. Donna Zafko lost her son, Jerry Zafko, in the Fallujah attack. She said, quote, "Congress can't change anything for my son, but let's see what they can do for the others out there, because someone needs to care for these contractors. Blackwater cares about nothing but the mighty dollar," she said. Meanwhile, more details have emerged on other shootings linked to Blackwater forces, aside from last week's mass shooting in Baghdad. McClatchy Newspapers reports the victims include four media workers killed over the past year. In February, Blackwater guards shot and killed Al-Atiyat television radio, television reporter named Suhad Shakir as she was driving to work. 5 days later, three Iraqi security guards were killed at the offices of the state-funded Iraqi Media Network, also known as Iraqiya. The three were picked off by Blackwater snipers on the opposite street. An Interior Ministry official says the guards were killed as if they were target practice. The Senate has approved a measure critics say promotes the partitioning of Iraq. The non-binding resolution supports dividing Iraq into federal regions for Iraqi Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki condemned the Senate vote, saying a partition would lead to catastrophe. Meanwhile, the Senate has also approved a measure critics say could help open the door to military action against Iran. The resolution calls on the State Department to designate the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist organization. Senators approved an amendment from Senators Joe Lieberman of Connecticut and John Kyle of Arizona threatening to, quote, combat, contain, and stop Iran via military instruments. Senator Jim Webb of Virginia called the vote Cheney's fondest pipe dream and said it could read as a backdoor method of gaining congressional validation for military action. The final vote was 76 to 22. Democratic presidential candidate Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton voted in favor of the measure. Rival hopeful Senator Barack Obama did not vote. The Senate has defied a veto threat from President Bush to approve an expansion of the child health insurance program known as SCHIP. The 67 to 29 vote would be enough to override a presidential veto. But a showdown looms since the House failed to attract a two-thirds majority in passing its version of the measure. The bill would spend $35 billion to expand health insurance to more than 4 million children. The money would come through a boost in the federal tobacco tax. President Bush has promised a veto because he says it would increase the government's role in health care. A group of American physicists says the Bush administration has made false claims in defending its plan for a missile system in Eastern Europe. The White House has reassured Russia by vowing that its system would not be able to catch Russian missiles, but six leading scientists, including Theodor Postol of MIT, say the proposed sites in Poland and the Czech Republic would be able to negate Russia's nuclear deterrent. Majorities in both Poland and the Czech Republic are opposed to hosting the missile system. The plan is widely seen as an overt threat to Iran. In Washington, D.C., dozens of protesters gathered outside a Bush administration-sponsored meeting of world leaders on climate change. The meeting comes just days after President Bush skipped a major global warming summit at the UN General Assembly. The White House says it's holding its own gathering so leading polluters can set individual voluntary emissions goals. Greenpeace Executive Director John Passacantando denounced Bush's stance.
Instead of denying global warming anymore, he wants to put together this lie that he's doing something about global warming. He's calling it voluntary. He's saying there's going to be no mandatory reductions of global warming pollution, but somehow that'll solve it. It's a lie and it's a fraud. And the American people need to know that. People around the world need to know that George Bush doesn't speak for we Americans.
Also at the rally was the environmental activist Ted Glick of Chesapeake Climate Action. He's on the 24th day of a hunger strike protesting the U.S. stance on global warming.
And then we have this conference on top of that, this sham conference that is a slap in the face to the nations of the world. There was a conference at the United Nations 2 days ago about coming up with a stronger international treaty, and then George Bush calls this conference to try to obstruct, to disrupt, and to move the wrong way on global warming.
The U.S.-sponsored climate meeting continues today. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration will allow 14 Guantanamo Bay prisoners the right to request lawyers for the first time since their capture. The move would grant the suspects their first outside contact, outside from representatives of the Red Cross. The 14 are all considered high-value detainees transferred from overseas CIA prisons last year. The group includes the alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. In campaign news, four leading Republican candidates are coming under criticism for skipping the first presidential debate geared towards African-American voters. Mitt Romney, Fred Thompson, Rudolph Giuliani, and Senator John McCain were all absent last night's debate at Baltimore's Morgan State University. They were each attending fundraising events. The debate was hosted by broadcaster Tavis Smiley. In other election news, GQ magazine has reportedly canceled a story critical of Hillary Rodham Clinton after her staffers threatened to cut off access to former President Bill Clinton. GQ was apparently told the former president would no longer talk to the magazine if it went ahead with an article detailing infighting within Hillary's campaign. An Iraq war veteran has announced he's returning his military medals as an act of anti-war protest. Josh Gaines was awarded the Global War on Terrorism Expeditionary Medal and National Defense Service Medal following a year-long tour of duty in 2004 and 2005. Gaines says he'll send the medals to former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld because he holds Rumsfeld responsible for sending him to Iraq. A newly leaked transcript from 1 month before the U.S. invasion of Iraq shows President Bush was aware that Saddam Hussein offered to go into exile if he was allowed to bring $1 billion and information on weapons of mass destruction. The disclosure is contained in a record of a meeting between President Bush and then Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar in February of 2003. The Middle East analyst Juan Cole speculates Saddam likely wanted to bring with him information that showed Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush had helped fund and support his weapons program. Possessing that information, Cole says, would have protected Saddam Hussein from future retaliation out of fear of embarrassing the White House. The transcript also shows President Bush hoped the UN Security Council would support the war in part because, quote, it would save us $50 billion. The $50 billion figure was the initial estimate of what the invasion would cost. Bush also made clear he expected U.S. forces to invade Iraq within a month of the conversation, regardless of U.N. approval. Bush and Aznar met on February 22nd. The U.S.-led invasion began on March 19th. Bush also reportedly said Europeans are opposed to the invasion because they're indifferent to Saddam's atrocities. He said, quote, maybe it's because he's dark-skinned, far away, and Muslim. A lot of Europeans think he's okay. White House spokesperson Gordon Jandro declined comment on the transcript. And federal prosecutors have announced they're now conducting a criminal investigation of the Chicago police torture scandal. For nearly two decades, a part of the city's jails, known as Area 2, was the epicenter for what's been described as the systematic torture of dozens of African-American males by Chicago police officers. In total, more than 135 people say they were subjected to abuse, including having guns forced into their mouths, bags placed over their heads, and electric shocks inflicted to their genitals. Four men have been released from death row after government investigators concluded torture led to their wrongful convictions. U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald says his office will probe whether former Chicago police commander John Berg and his subordinates lied under oath or obstructed investigations into the allegations. Fitzgerald also says prosecutors have reopened an investigation into the 1987 fire that led to the conviction of one of the torture victims. The victim, Madison Hobley, has sued Berg and more than 20 officers for allegedly coercing him into falsely confessing to murders. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Twin City Public Broadcasting in St. Paul, Minnesota. In Burma, the military junta is continuing its violent crackdown on the most vocal popular uprising against its rule in nearly two decades. Burmese soldiers and police are baton-charging groups of demonstrators gathering in the city of Rangoon. State-run television admitted nine people had been killed Thursday, but Australia's ambassador in Burma, Bob Davis, told his country's ABC radio that the real death toll is probably several times higher. One of the people killed on Thursday was Japanese photojournalist Kenji Nagai. Video footage shows him being shot point blank when soldiers charged the crowds. Japan said it would make an official protest over his death. All the main roads into central Rangoon have been blocked. Soldiers have been progressively moving into barricades, moving the barricades to seal off central neighborhoods. Security forces have also sealed off the five main monasteries that were focal points of previous mass marches and are trying to prevent further protests. Buddhist monks have been leading the nearly 2 weeks of popular protests against the ruling junta. But after a series of raids on monasteries and arrests of dozens of monks, there were few, if any, in the crowd on Friday. At least six Buddhist monks have been killed so far. Most of the news coming out of Burma this week has been from citizen journalists who have sent pictures and video to international media outlets. But the military junta is cracking down on the use of cell phones and cutting internet access in an attempt to stem the flow of information. President Bush has condemned the crackdown and has tightened sanctions on Burma's military leaders. Bush called on China, one of Burma's closest neighbors and a main trading partner, to put more pressure on Burma. Beijing has urged all parties to maintain restraint, but has refused to condemn the junta. Tun Ang Jao is the president of the U.S.-based Civil Society for Burma. He's a former president of the All-Burma Student Democratic Front that led protests in 1974 and 88. He was imprisoned for 5 years in Burma and came to the United States in 1992 after living in the jungle on the Burmese-Thai border for 4 years. He now lives in Chicago, joining us in our Firehouse studio today in New York. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. You were yesterday at the United Nations?
Yes. We
are. What are you calling for?
We are demonstrating against the junta, and we are showing our solidarity with the monks and the people in the United States.
And what information are you getting out of Burma right now, the country that the military regime has renamed Myanmar?
We heard that they are cracking down the monks, and they're getting in the monastery at night and beat them and force them to crawl on the floor, and the head monks were beating with his bantons and kick his head several times, and a lot of blood will spill out. And the security guard said, don't wash it. Just let them see the people. And they deserve this. So like that, a lot of monasteries were raided and a lot of monks were arrested at night, also including the opposition party leaders, U Aung Shui and the CRPB, like Parliament Representative Committee, these members are also arrested.
Protests against the Burmese military junta have been taking place around the world. In New York, scores of Buddhist monks and Burmese exiles marched Thursday from the United Nations to the Burmese mission on 77th Street. Democracy Now! Was there to cover the story.
Why are you here today?
Today, no, because the government, the military government, they are killing the monk and the peaceful protesters in my country.
Military government in Burma has been brutalizing people. That's why I'm here to protest.
They are the worst in the war, and they don't have a religion. They don't believe nothing. They care only power. And for their power, they can kill anybody.
Here, you have your right, you have your freedom, and then you have, like, freedom of speech, freedom of everything, you know. But in our country, they didn't do anything. They just walk on the street peacefully, and they just call for democracy, and then, you know, they have been killed for that.
We need a democracy in Burma because since 1962 to until now, we have no democracy, no human rights, and no, it's only one-party system.
We don't have time for listening to Security Council because Russia and China always block. So this time is EU or NATO. They have to do something. If they laugh about human rights, because they kill regular all the people from Burma, they kill all the monks, they break all the Buddha statue in the monastery, and they don't care even the all the Buddhist whatever we have inside the Burma, they don't care no more. They break everything.
I hope that what people want, that democracy will come to Burma.
And I really want to call for the citizens of the United States, you know, to think about that there are some people who really need help. And I just want them to, you know, to call the government and to stop killing people inside.
People protesting outside the United Nations and outside the Burmese mission yesterday in New York. As we return to our guest, I wanted to ask Tung Ung Jao about your own experience in Burma. How were you arrested and what happened in 1988 when 3,000 people were killed by the Burmese regime?
I was a student leader in 1974 Udan Uprising. And after that, we make another demonstration in March and June. In June 1975, after the demonstration, I was arrested and sent to a prison. It's called insane prison. A lot of people were insane in this prison because it's a very cruel treatment we have. So I was sentenced to life, but luckily get out from prison in 1980. And after that, I still continue our struggle. In 1988, we led the students and monks and workers together. We make a nationwide demonstration. And people cry out for democracy. And we are peacefully demonstrating like right now in 1988. The whole people demanded for democracy. It's really inspiring because only not in the city, in Rangoon, it's the whole country, like Mandalay, Molimings, and other towns and small towns and cities. All people walk out and demand for democracy. But after 1.5 months demonstrating against the regime, the army stepped in and they opened fire the crowd. And at least 3,000 unarmed demonstrators were killed, and including in this dead high school and middle school students, young students were shot and killed.
Tung Ung Jao, you said that you were held at the insane prison.
Yeah.
We understand that the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Aung San Suu Kyi, who's been held under house arrest for years, just seen this weekend for the first time. We got a glimpse of her on video, that she's been moved into that prison. Are you concerned?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about her health and condition, because insane town, we call town is a prison. Insane town is a very big, and also inside there's a different kind of cells. Number one cell, number two, number three, number four, number five, and number six cells. They have a different condition. And number six cells is like two dose cells. The airflow is very tight. You can't breathe sometimes. So I was in this cell for at least 3 weeks, and I understand how hard it is to breathe in. So I was worried that they might put her in the cell, or they might make her crazy. You know, insane prison have a very methodically they torture people. They have to isolate you, or they have to put you in the den, or they have to put you in the dog cell with the dogs, you know, like that. And also, there's a not sufficient food. Only rice and the watery soup you have. And a lot of people are dying when they are walking like a zombie. Their body was swelling and they die.
Tong and Zhao, we're going to continue to follow this story and keep our listeners and viewers around the world updated. I want to thank you very much for joining us from New York after you participated in the protests at the UN and the Burmese mission there. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Chanting in Lampang. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Twin Cities Public Television in St. Paul, Minnesota. We broadcast on over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and low power FM and college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish in audio and transcript form for any radio station to take around the world. As we turn now to the issue of torture, Minneapolis is the home of the Center for Victims of Torture, an organization that works to heal the wounds of torture in individuals, their families, their communities, and to stop torture worldwide. We're joined by the center's executive director, Douglas Johnson. Dr. Stephen Miles is also with us. He's a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a faculty member of its Center for Bioethics. He's the author of the book Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror. But before we go to our guests, I want to play an excerpt from Wednesday's Democratic debate at Dartmouth College. It aired on MSNBC and was moderated by Tim Russert.
I want to move to another subject, and this involves a comment that a guest on Meet the Press made, and I want to read it as follows. Imagine the following scenario. We get lucky. We get the number three guy in Al-Qaeda. We know there's a big bomb going off in America in 3 days, and we know this guy knows where it is. Don't we have the right and responsibility to beat it out of him? You could set up a law where the president could make a finding or could guarantee a pardon. President Obama, would you do that as president?
America cannot sanction torture. It's a very straightforward principle, and one that we should abide by. Now, I will do whatever it takes to keep America safe. And there are going to be all sorts of hypotheticals and emergency situations, and I will make that judgment at that time. But what we cannot do is have the President of the United States state as a matter of policy that there is a loophole or an exception where we would sanction torture. I think that diminishes us, and it sends the wrong message to the world.
Senator Biden, would you allow this presidential exception?
No, I would not, and I met up here in New Hampshire with 17 4-3 and 4-star generals who, after my making a speech at Drake Law School, pointing out I would not under any circumstances sanction torture, I thought they were about to read me the riot act. 17 of our 4-star and 3-star generals said, Biden, will you make a commitment? You will never use torture. It does not work, and it's part of the reason why we got the faulty information on Iraq in the first place, because it was engaged in by one person who gave whatever answer they were thought they were going to give in order to stop being tortured. It doesn't work. It should be no part of our policy ever.
Senator Clinton, this is the number three man in Al-Qaeda. We know there's a bomb about to go off, and we have 3 days, and we know this guy knows where it is. Should there be a presidential exception to allow torture in that kind of situation?
You know, Tim, I agree with what Joe and Barack have said. As a matter of policy, it cannot be American policy, period. I met with those same 3- and 4-star retired generals, and their principal point, in addition to the values that are so important for our country to exhibit, is that there is very little evidence that it works. Now, there are a lot of other things that we need to be doing that I wish we were: better intelligence, making our, you know, our country better respected around the world, working to have more allies. But these hypotheticals are very dangerous because they open a great big hole in what should be an attitude that our country and our president takes toward the appropriate treatment of everyone. And I think it's dangerous to go down this path.
The guest who laid out this scenario for me with that proposed solution was William Jefferson Clinton last year. So he disagrees with you.
Well, he's not standing here right now.
So there is a disagreement.
Well, I'll talk to him later.
That was an excerpt from Wednesday's Democratic presidential debate at Dartmouth College. We're joined now in St. Paul, Minnesota, by Douglas Johnson at the Center for Victims of Torture and Dr. Stephen Miles, author of the book Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror. Dr. Miles, let's begin with you. Your response.
What Joe Biden said was that he would not ever order torture. What Ms. Clinton said was that we would never have a policy for torture, but she did not rule out the possibility of an executive order for torture in a specific circumstance. And Barack Obama was very hard to read on this matter. So the only clear statement came from Joe Biden. And I think that further clarification on this needs to be addressed. It's not just that there's no evidence, but the National Intelligence University, in a huge analysis of this last year, earlier this year, found that there's no evidence that torture works, or and furthermore, that it leads subjects to provide misinformation and to become recalcitrant to cooperation with providing information that we need.
How did you get involved with this issue?
Well, when I saw the pictures at Abu Ghraib, I was stunned, and the question was, where was the prison medical staff? Why didn't they blow the whistle on it? And I figured that what they'd done is that they had attempted to blow the whistle on it and that their reports had been suppressed. And what I found was that the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology was suppressing information about deaths from torture, and that the medical staff, including psychiatrists and psychologists, were actually integrated into the system of devising coercive interrogations.
And so you wrote this book, Oath Betrayed. When we were doing the Burma segment, you made an interesting comment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you take that, the speaker that you had, he was talking about the use of dogs, close confinement in crowded cells, meal deprivation. All of these are techniques which are currently approved against the use of prisoners that we're holding, which, by the way, I'd point out, as in Burma, 85% in Iraq are innocent or ignorant of insurgency activity. And it is very difficult for us to say to Burma, don't do these techniques, when we have said as a matter of national policy that in national emergency, given national sovereignty, that we can embark on torture.
The ticking time bomb theory that Tim Russert posed?
I've looked at every instance of a ticking time bomb that's been proposed in the war on terror. All of them are not what the government has said they are. In fact, basically, there is never a circumstance where you know that a particular prisoner has a particular information and will yield with a particular amount of pressure. In fact, gathering intelligence is a matter of pulling information gradually from a number of sources who you recruit through a rapport building. One of the fascinating things about the ticking time bomb scenario is it has elicited bad information which has sent our troops on dangerous and fatal missions as they go and chase down wild goose chases to get bad chasing down bad information. And furthermore, the sole source for the information that bioweapons were being developed jointly by Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda came from a guy that we kidnapped in Sweden, took to Egypt and tortured, and that made it to the UN, was part of the authorization to go to war.
We have been doing extensive coverage of the debate in the American Psychological Association. They, this year, ultimately did not pass a moratorium on psychologists' involvement in coercive interrogations. Can you talk more about what is going on there and the contrast with the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association?
Essentially, what the American Psychological Association has said is that psychologists may work with interrogators to break persons down. And it turns out that that was the specific agenda all the way from the beginning, including when military people were stacked on their interrogation policy committee. The directive from then-President Kuchar, as expressed in his emails, said as follows. The goal of such psychologists' works will ultimately be the protection of others' innocence by contributing to the incarceration, debilitation, or even death of the potential perpetrator, who will often remain unaware of the psychologist's involvement. And then a month later, he said to that same American Psychological Association Policy Committee, I have zero interest in entangling the American Psychological Association with nebulous, toothless, contradictory and obfuscatory treaties that comprise, quote, international law, close quote. Rather, I prefer to see the American Psychological Association take principled stand on policy issues where psychology has some scientific basis for doing so. Well, the irony of this is that the scientific evidence weighs against course of interrogation. And the psychologists should have put the brake on the CIA, but in fact, they worked with the CIA to develop these techniques, which then spread through the Army and have resulted in enormous damage.
How did you get that email of the former president of the APA, Gerald Kuchar?
What happened was that there was a task force that was set up to do this. 9 out of the 12 members were related to the military. 3 weren't. One, Jean Maria Arrigo, has made the email correspondence to that committee available, and this is being and currently being posted up on various websites.
We've interviewed Jean Maria Arrigo on Democracy Now. Doug Johnson, your thoughts on this issue. You are the head of the Center for Torture Victims here in Minneapolis. It's very unusual to have such a center. There are only a few in the United States, is that right?
Well, fortunately, there are over 30 now.
Oh, over 30.
And we all work as closely together as possible to learn from each other. And I think the experience for all of us is that we care for people who the rest of the community would consider innocent victims of torture, but all of those survivors would tell you that they would have said anything at all that was wanted of them eventually to get the torture to stop. And so they'll confess, they'll give the information that's fed to them, because the person who most needs a confession is the torturer. Without that confession, the torturer has no justification for what they've done. And the only way that torture states manage the dissonance in the morale and the minds of their torturers is that a confession emerges. And that's one of the key reasons why truth doesn't emerge from torture. Anything could emerge. Sometimes it's a danger. But one of the big problems of the focus on the ticking time bomb is it's really an enormous distraction. The focus on just what's happening in the interrogation center and the tactics of interrogation have obscured for most of us, and especially our policymakers, what the strategic results of torture are. And one of those key strategic results is this. I spent some time with Alberto Mora, who had been the Navy legal counsel who fought against the torture policy, someone you should have on your show, when we were visiting members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he emphasized that the reason we have the Geneva Accords, of course, emerging from the way Allied troops were dealt with by the Nazis in the Japanese prison camps, was the notion that if a soldier knows that they will be treated humanely, when they are trapped and they have no place to go, they have at least the opportunity of surrendering. But if they know they will be treated cruelly, if they will be tortured, if they will be otherwise treated without dignity, then the total incentive for them is to fight to the last man. And under those circumstances, and under the circumstances we now have in Iraq, when we are overpowering a group with firepower, we have given them the total incentive to fight to the last man. And that endangers American troops right now. Americans die from this policy because we have falsely thought that the creation of fear keeps us safe rather than endangers us.
How do you treat victims of torture at the center?
Well, we have a multidisciplinary team.
How many victims are there now?
Well, we believe there are about 30,000 just in Minnesota. At least 500,000 in the United States. They've come from so many countries. We've provided care for people from almost 80 countries.
And how many are in your center now?
We only have the capacity for about 300 a year, which means we have 100 years of work sitting in the state right now. So one of our key roles is to be the learning center, to learn the impact of torture and what we do about it, and try and engage the broader mainstream healthcare program to do what ought to be done in the healthcare system. That's an enormous struggle. So in addition to our care, we have major programs with as many resources as we could put together to train mainstream survivors. We also have a contract to provide the technical assistance to the other centers in the U.S., and we work with 17 centers in parts of the world where torture is used to try and reinforce them and really broaden the capacity in the world to work with people.
I think when a lot of people think torture, they think other countries. In our headlines, we read the story of what's happening in Chicago, and the expose is around one of the top police for years, John Berg, and his torture victims. What is your response to that?
Well, our friends at the Kovler Center in Chicago have been engaged in this case, and one advantage of the treatment centers is also to be able to begin to develop forensic evidence in these kinds of cases. So our colleagues in the human rights community have been really the impetus behind this investigation. Torture occurs everywhere, and including the United States. What has distinguished us, for the most part, is that in the U.S., when it does occur, we have active investigations and intervention. And that this occurred over a decade in Chicago really indicates a very high level of corruption, which I would have to say, in the world where we see torture occurring, there is a very high correlation always with corruption.
Professor McCoy, who wrote the book A Question of Torture, said psychological torture is worse than physical. Is that true?
But that was a surprise to me when I arrived at the center 19 years ago, because, again, I had the imagination of that it's the physical. But our clients tell us that the physical, they don't always remember. I think it's sort of like a woman who gives birth. Why would she give birth again? There's something about the actual pain of the event that fades. And what they tell us is that the subject of their nightmares are the psychological forms of torture, the mock executions, observing other people being tortured. But what we have seen is that the processes of psychological torture have become much, much more utilized and more highly sophisticated over the years.
Professor Miles.
There was a terrific study that was done of Bosnian survivors, came out last year. And what it found was that in terms of causing post-traumatic stress disorder, that physical torture, emotional torture, and sexual torture, or the intensity or duration of torture, were not associated with a greater or lesser likelihood of PTSD. And so that emotional torture, such as, say, being forced to witness the rape of a loved one or a mock execution, is just as likely to cause long-term disability as physical torture.
What about the ones that the U.S. military, CIA, et cetera, have engaged in, like isolation, sleep deprivation, sensory deprivation?
The means that we have used basically resemble those used by all other countries, with the single exception that we have not used mutilation, that is, cutting off hands or ears, which have been done in some countries. But in terms of the range of physical abuses, from electrical, thermal, hypothermic beating, and various forms of emotional trauma, they look exactly like other countries.
What do you think of the APA debate? What's been going on? Why the APA hasn't passed a moratorium?
Well, I can't really speculate on why. There is a fair amount of speculation, but I think it's just that. Certainly, when the psychiatrist said that we will not participate in this, they got blown off of these interrogation panels. The APA current position is essentially dovetailed to continue substantial involvement with the Central Intelligence Agency. And furthermore, they very specifically stated that physicians or psychologists could work in secret prisons with an option of leaving if they wanted, but not with an obligation to call attention to the abuses within secret prisons. And so the APA policy is fundamentally designed to work with a secret prison system, which is the worst form of danger to prisoners.
I think it's important to understand, and this is an example of it, that currently in today's world, there are more healthcare professionals involved in the design and structuring of torture than there are those who are involved in providing care for survivors.
Say that again.
There are more healthcare people involved in the design and the instrumentation of torture than there are involved in providing healing for the survivors.
In this country?
No.
In the world.
Around the world.
In the world. And it is in many times because healthcare people get engaged and confused by the same ticking time bomb theories that fuel 24 and other fantasy programs, which have unfortunately seemed to be the basis of learning for many of our policymakers. It's fantasy-driven, and it causes people to do stupid things.
Dr. Miles.
About 130 countries torture, but of the survivors, somewhere between 20% and 50% report seeing a health professional directly involved in supervising the torture. And that doesn't count the ones who never see the physician who falsely certifies the cause of death as natural causes. So it's actually around 40% of survivors actually see the health practitioner involved in the torture. And, you know, as Doug said, about 1% of the torture victims in Minnesota are actually getting treatment.
And finally, Doug Johnson, your view of the whole controversy within the American Psychological Association, and have you taken a stance on this, your center?
Well, we see ourselves as a technical and professional organization, and we try and feed people the information that comes from our work. I have to say, though, that in my view, there's a strong parallel here with what happened in Uruguay at the height of the repression in Uruguay. And here you had really a struggle between two groups of psychologists. The dominant group in Uruguay were psychoanalytic. The emerging group were behavioralists. And they were second-class citizens in the psychological world. Therefore, they allied themselves with the military in designing systems of torture, of designing the whole structure of what was called Libertad prison, so that it became an ongoing instrument of torment and disruption and psychological dissonance within the minds of the prisoners, a situation that was so bad that it was the very first report from the ICRC that was released to the public, the second only being what we know about Guantanamo. And so it's hard for us not to see that those parallels, that that there may be a bigger struggle in the way psychology is going, and some are aligning the wrong way.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Stephen Miles, author of the book Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror, and Doug Johnson, head of the Center for Torture Victims here in St. Paul, Minneapolis. The specific name is the Center for Victims of Torture. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
My heart is your stone, I'll throw with you. No llores, no pierdas la fe, la sed, la calma el que hace. Agua de la arena, y tú que te levantas con orgullo entre las piedras. Has hecho mares de este polvo.
Yeah. I throw stones at my eyes, for too long they've been dry. Plus they see what they shouldn't from oppressed babies to thighs. I throw stones at my tongue, cause shit should really keep its peace. I throw stones at my feet, cause the straying lead to defeat. Couple of big ones at my heart, cause the thing is freezing cold. But my nuff's still alive and kicking, unstoppable on the roll. I throw bricks at the devil, so I'll be sure to hit him. But first at the man in the mirror, so I can chase out the venom.
Little boy, shining ahead. Just another kiss and I to get some bread. Not the first murder, nor the last. Again and again, a repetition of the past.
Since the very first day, same story.
Young ones, old ones, some glory. How can it be? Has the whole world turned blind? Or is it just cause it's only affecting my kind? If these walls could speak, imagine what would they say? Me, this path that I walk on, there's only one way.
Bones may kill, bones may break.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Twin Cities Public Television in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Amy Goodman. An immigrant rights group based in Minnesota has sued ICE, the U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement, over its raid last year of the Swift meatpacking plant in Worthington, Minnesota. On December 12th, federal agents raided Swift plants across six states. More than 1,200 undocumented workers were arrested overall, including more than 200 workers in Worthington. The lawsuit claims that federal agents insulted, abused, and humiliated the plaintiffs on account of their race. The suit says female Latina workers were ordered to disrobe in front of federal agents during the raid, while white workers were allowed to move about the plant freely. Gloria Contreras-Eden joins me here in St. Paul. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. I appreciate you having me here today.
You are the executive director of Centro Legal, the immigrant rights groups that filed the lawsuit. Can you talk about the lawsuit and the people you represent?
Yes, I can. Thank you. The lawsuit was filed on September 4th of this year, the day after Labor Day, and it's on behalf of 10 plaintiffs who are either U.S. citizens, legal permanent residents, or those who are authorized to work in this country. We are alleging constitutional violations. What's important to recognize in this particular case is that this really wasn't a typical immigration raid. This was part of a criminal investigation that the government had been conducting for possibly over a year. They had a list of people whom they could have gone in, picked up without any disrupt to the companies, to the communities, and they chose not to. And so whenever you're part of a criminal investigation, now I'm not a criminal lawyer, but I know enough to say that when you're part of a criminal investigation, you're afforded certain protections. You're afforded the protection of an unreasonable detention. You're also afforded the protection to have the right to remain silent, the right to counsel. You're also afforded the protection to be able to speak to an attorney if an attorney is available to you. In all these situations, across the country, people were not afforded these rights. And so that's why we filed this lawsuit.
Explain, and we don't have much time, but explain how the raid went down in Worthington.
Well, we know that approximately 100-plus agents descended upon this Swift company packing plant in Worthington, Minnesota. And we know that we also know that the employer, Swift & Company, supervisors were working with the agents and preventing people from leaving the site. So they surrounded the premises with agents and their vehicles. They pulled up approximately six buses to load people up, and then they systematically and procedurally started rounding up people who were of Latino descent. And it's important to recognize here that people who did not look Latino were allowed to roam freely throughout the plant. And so those who were Latino, even if you were a citizen or a resident, were required to prove that they were here lawfully. Now, I personally can't prove that I'm a U.S. citizen. I wouldn't know how to do it. But in this case, they required everyone to do it upon the threat of deportation and removal.
Were people deported?
Yes, they were.
How many?
We don't know how many there were deported because some were deported immediately and some are still under removal proceedings. Our agency is also challenging the constitutionality of the removal proceedings.
And what are you asking for? What are you demanding?
Well, we're asking for injunctive, declaratory, and monetary damages. Now, what that means essentially is when you ask for injunctive relief, you're asking them to stop this conduct, this practice. When you're asking for declaratory relief, you're asking that that the federal court declare that this is wrong, unconstitutional. And, of course, the monetary damages are self-explanatory.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We will continue to follow this lawsuit and also the activities of the ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
Gloria Contreras-Eden, attorney and executive director of Centro Legal, a nonprofit law firm that provides legal services to low-income Latinos in the area of immigration law and family law here in Minnesota. That does it for the broadcast today. I look forward to meeting public radio program directors in Minneapolis. Tonight, I'll be be in Seattle, 6:30 at the Social Justice Fund Northwest Annual Dinner at the Seattle Marriott Waterfront. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Aaron Mate, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Nicole Salazar, Steve Martinez, Jeffrey Hagerman, Anjali Kamat, Carrie Mache. Our website is democracynow.org. There you can get transcripts, audio, and video of our broadcast. You can podcast. You can also sign up for our Daily Digest. I also want to thank Dennis Moynihan here in Minnesota and Twin Cities Public Television. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you.